Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about inode-based file systems. So we mentioned this concept of an inode, which stores basically all the information about a file except for its name. And our directory entries in the system, we still have them, but they just specify a name and a location in this array of inodes that would be at the beginning of our disk. And if we're storing all the information about a file in one place, that includes the information about where the file's data is, and we had pointers to the data logs. But if our inodes are just fixed-size array of things, that doesn't quite actually work out for very large files. But for short, small files, it does. And we learned small files are more common, so typically, on the average file, we'll only use things in the inode, but sometimes that's not going to be good enough. So we had what we called indirect, double indirect, possibly more layers of indirect pointers, where we'd have, instead of a pointer to the data for a file, we'd have a pointer to an array of pointers. That for a single indirect block, those pointers would point to the data for a file. We had the double indirect where we said, okay, well, it wasn't good enough to have a pointer to an array of pointers to the data, so let's make it a pointer to an array of pointers to more pointers for the data, and keep going, so we can store more and more things. So we had the indirect pointers for big files. And we mentioned, okay, so this is a scheme which works, people have used, but we might be a little dissatisfied about how this works for very large files. Yes, we found a way to store very large files, but there's actually a lot of work we're doing managing these giant list of block numbers for very large files, in particular if we want to keep our block sizes small, which is going to be better at not wasting space for small files. So an alternate scheme, instead of storing these lists of block pointers, is to store extents. So we'd store a start block and a size, and we store possibly a list of these or a tree of these, and this would allow us to represent a large file with a lot fewer numbers. But we'd have more challenge of, like, first of all, allocating these. We have to find a bunch of blocks together that are free. That's something we didn't have to worry about before. We have to make sure that we can, you know, look in these when we want to seek to the file. With just our normal block pointer arrays, we wanted to get to a particular part of the file, we knew exactly where to look. With these extents, we're back to scanning the list, or doing something like that, or having some sort of tree data structure we can do a lookup in that's going to be a lot more complicated to manage in order to find some byte in the middle of the file. But we're probably saving a lot of space as far as storing metadata, so it's probably worthwhile, and this is why many modern file systems support this, even if they also use block pointers for small files. Block pointer arrays, I should say. So then we started talking about reliability. So file systems, we care about having your data sort of be kept intact, and one thing we cared about was consistency, that we want it to be the case that, you know, if I move a file, either I move the file or I didn't if there's like a crash and the system comes back up. I don't want to see some sort of in-between state where my file is only half moved, and this causes weird things like I can access something which is not really there, or if I delete a file, it actually deletes some other file. So we want to provide this sort of consistency, and a way we can do this is by implementing what we call transactions, that we have sort of operations that occur all at once together. And a scheme for doing this was redo logging. So we'd write our intention to the logs. We write, here's all the things I'm going to do, for example, to create a file or to move a file. We write that all together to a log before we actually do the operation. Then we do the operation. And on a crash, on boot, we check this log and see what things were we doing and which of them are marked committed, meaning that we've finished writing the whole operation. And if for everything that was committed, we'd redo that operation from the beginning making sure that it would actually happen. And this meant that we prevent users from observing partial operations, that we'd always, you know, be able to, even if we lost our stuff in memory that told us about the file move, we'd always recover that information from the log, or we discard the entire operation. So we never have this in-between state. So questions on these things we covered last time? Yes? What type of information would this log actually contain? So this contains a list of the changes, updates we've made to do some operation. So an example, in XV6, the format of the log is I wrote this, write this data to this sender, is what they put in the log. There's other things you could choose to put, but you just have to record what the operation is. We'll talk a little today about the format that that should take or should not take. Other questions? Yes?
So stats are basically most useful whenever we have contiguous memory, so then using like real world examples.
Quick question. Extents are most useful when we have contiguous memory. When we have contiguous sector blocks on our disk free, yes, they are most useful in that case. Typically, we're going to have that. The challenge is that, you know, we have to do extra work to find large contiguous sets versus finding individual blocks free. So it's going to be more challenging to allocate. And of course, in the worst case, we won't have contiguous things free, though hopefully that's right. Other questions? Okay. So last time we talked about sort of our sort of redo logging operation. So we'd write sort of our transaction steps. We, you know, say if we're creating a file, here are the data blocks I want to create. Here's the directory update for that file creation. Here's the inode update for that file creation. And then we write commit transaction. And then we'd actually do the updates to the disk. So something which I think was a little point of confusion is that, well, probably for the file creation, we've recorded all this stuff in memory probably before we start, but we have to get it to the disk. And the way we're going to get it to the disk is we're going to first write it to a log, then we're going to write commit, then we're going to write to the actual sort of canonical locations for this information on the disk. And after we do that, we'll reclaim the space in the log, so we'll free up some space in the log because we don't need that log anymore because that operation is now actually permanent on the disk. And our recovery is when, if we boot up and things weren't finished before, we redo the log to check for that. And if the operation isn't committed, we just say no, meaning that if we don't actually get this far in recording the operation, we're just going to not do it at all. And if it is committed, we redo the whole thing. And then we reclaim space in the log. Questions about this process? Yes?
Can you explain the difference between writing the transaction steps and writing the commit transaction?
Can I explain the difference between writing the transaction steps and writing the commit transaction? So we're writing them to the same place, but when we write the transactions, as we're writing the transaction steps, they might take up a lot of space, and we're going to ignore if we see, like, if I see these two transaction steps without a commit, I'm just going to ignore them, because I assume I just haven't finished writing my transaction steps. So the commit tells us we've written all the transaction steps. So if we don't see a commit, we just say, must not have written all the transaction steps, let's ignore this operation. Does that answer your question?
So it's just like an extra, so the commit transaction is just an extra step to verify that you've written all the transaction steps?
Question, the commit transaction is to verify, just to verify we've written all the steps? Yes, that is its purpose. We need some explicit marker so we can tell the difference between I just didn't have this operation in this transaction versus I had everything. Other questions? Yes? Question, if we crash for a reclaim space in the log, does it matter because we already did it? So it doesn't matter if we like try to reclaim space and we fail, it shouldn't matter. Because we should be able to redo reclaiming space in the log without any loss. Yes. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so something notable about what we have to write to the log is we have to write things that are okay to do twice. Because in a failure case, we could do things multiple times, possibly many times. Like if we, if the system crashes, I reboot, try to redo the operations, then it crashes again. I could reboot again, try to do it a third time. So it has to be safe to redo the operations many times. And usually this means that we want to write log entries which say things like, hey, set this inode's link count to 4. We don't want to write entries which say, like, increment the link count. If we set the link count to 4 too many times, it's still going to be 4. If we increment it too many times, it's going to be who knows what. So we just need to be careful about that, and that's just mostly about choosing what we record in the log, carefully to make sure that we're aware that it might be done multiple times. Questions on this idempotency idea? Yes? Sorry, what is the inode link count? So when we talked about inodes on XV6, remember we could have multiple directory entries that point to one? And the link count is the recording of how many entries point. Other questions? Yes? Question, in the last slide I said I ignore any operation with no commit. Shouldn't it be the last way around because, it hasn't been done? So we assume that any operation with no commit, we don't have the full information, so we can't do it. We assume that if I don't see a commit, that probably we didn't actually write all the steps of the operation, and I'm not going to want to partially do an operation.
Is that a safe assumption?
Question, is that a safe assumption? So by making this choice to ignore any partial operation without a commit, I am saying that if you don't write enough of the operation to write the commit, the whole thing, we are not gonna try to recover data from that. That is a choice we are making. And it's a choice we are making because hopefully it will avoid inconsistency. But you might observe that, wait a moment, maybe we could sometimes recover information the user otherwise would have lost. This is something we're not gonna do, because it might make us have an inconsistent state of our file system. Okay, so that's redo logging. We write our intended operation to the log, we write a marker to say I have the whole operation in the log, and that we're gonna promise to do it eventually at that point, and then we actually do the updates later. And we make sure we actually do those updates even if there's a crash by redoing them. Yes?
So, even if you commit an operation successfully, you still redo it during the recovery stage?
Question, even if I commit an operation successfully, I still redo it during the recovery stage? As long as it is in the log, if I complete the operation before crashing and reclaim the space in the log, then I won't redo it.
It says already that the case that happened twice.
So it's possible that the crash happens while these steps here are happening, or after these steps have happened, but before we reclaim space in the log. In that case, we will redo one or more of the parts of the operation, and that should be fine. That answer your question? Okay, so file systems that do redo logging are commonly called by the term journaling file systems, and the log is called a journal. So a little exercise on this. So let's say we're appending 100 kilobytes and we're using redo logging. What things are going to be modified by this operation here with the inode-based file system? Question?
Is there a crash?
Question, is there a crash? In this example, normal operation. Question? So the question is, how do I deal with 9 item per 10 operations? Question, how do I deal with implementing redo logging and 9 item per 10 things? So we saw the example of, you know, if I wanted to set a length count, right? If I want to increment the length count, I just figure out what should it be incremented to, and I write that down instead of writing increment the length count. So that's probably the simplest way. There's other strategies you might use too. Who'd like some more time? A few people. Okay, who thinks A is modified? Okay, so we have, seems like a plurality for that, and I would agree, we have to allocate blocks for the file. Who thinks B is modified, or data blocks for the file? We have to write the data we're appending, hopefully. I'm surprised not to see more, okay. So the data we're appending, appended, the to allocate space for the new data. How about indirect blocks for the file? Okay, most people think that, and that's yes, because to point to the new blocks, we're probably not gonna have enough block pointers with 1 kilobyte blocks. We're probably not gonna have 100 or 200 block pointers in the file. So we're gonna need to modify an indirect block to point to them. How about data blocks for the directory? Okay, a couple people there. So in our directory, so I would say we should not be modifying this. And the reason why is that our directory entry with inodes is just file name, comma, inode number. And this information isn't changing. So if this were fat, the answer would be yes, we have to modify the data blocks for the directory because our directory entry stores things like the size. But here, it doesn't. It doesn't store anything we need to change. So we don't need to modify the directory data blocks. We're just going to leave them the same. That's going to be fine. How about the inode for the file? Okay, most people. So I would say yes. So update the size and modification time information. How about the inode for the directory? Okay, a couple people. I would say no. I understand an argument that we might want to update a modification time in there, but that's usually not how Unix systems have decided to make modification times work, even though it's not an unreasonable choice. Usually we don't consider a directory modified if only files in the directory are modified. We only consider it modified if we change the list of files that's in the directory. Yes? Question, is it possible to overflow the files so we have to modify the way we store the data in the inode? That's what modifying indirect blocks would be about, right? If we did that, we'd allocate a new indirect block, and that's accounted for there. And we'd also modify the inode possibly to point to that.
So if we didn't have indirect blocks, then we would have to modify the directory?
Question, if we didn't have indirect blocks, then we have to modify the directory. With inode-based schemes, all our information about the file, except for its name, is in the inode. Therefore, our directory contains no information that depends on where, on how big the file is, or anything like that. Just contains an index into an array, and there's no reason we'd have to change what that index is because every inode can store the same type of information. Does that answer your question? Okay. How about the log? Who thinks we modify the log as part of this? Yes, so if we're doing redo logging, we would definitely modify the log because every operation goes through the log. Yes?
When you said any data blocks for the file, do you mean like the direct blocks or just any data block that might be mapped to?
Question, by data blocks for the file, I was meaning the ones that were not used to store pointers.
Okay.
But the answer is the same either way.
Wouldn't the direct blocks, like the initial 12, not be modified since we're only modified?
Question, would the initial 12 blocks not be modified? Yes. Okay. Sorry, yeah. But all the blocks that store data for the file is what I meant, but even if you include the ones that store pointers for the file, still would work. But yes, if you only include the ones that are pointed through by the direct pointers, no. Yeah? Question, shouldn't the net result be no changes to the log? Yes. So we're going to modify the log. Yes, though we will eventually clear it. Question?
When do we clear the log?
When we know that all of the operations recorded elsewhere on the disk. Yeah? Can I explain why D is false? So the directory data blocks store our directory entries for inode-based file systems. And all our directory entries need to contain is a file name and an inode number, an index into the inode array. And nothing about this operation changes the inode number or the file name. So we don't need to change that directory. Question, Becca?
Can you explain how both the data block and the indirect blocks are modified?
Can I explain how both the data block and the indirect blocks are modified? So by indirect blocks, here I mean the blocks that store the pointers for the file. And if we think of our inode for this file, we have our inode, which has a bunch of direct pointers. These all don't change, right? Because it's only the beginning of the file. We have an indirect pointer that points to a block of things. And we have to add some new pointers to here to point to new blocks. So the changes are happening in our new blocks and in these pointers here. The pointers there are the changes to the indirect blocks. What I mean by that, I probably should have been more explicit that I mean the blocks that contain the pointers that's pointed to by the indirect pointer directly, and also the data blocks themselves. We have to put the data in. Does that answer your question? Yes? How am I supposed to derive intuition from the numbers that are given? So if you remember our file system, our inode examples, we had always had way less than 100 block pointers in it. So that tells you that we're using at least an indirect pointer, maybe a double indirect pointer to handle this file. Does that answer your question? Question, how do I know it's going to modify data blocks and not just the indirect blocks? So by indirect blocks here, I meant equals blocks holding pointers. Block pointers. That's the blocks I meant by this. I probably should have been more explicit. And if we're making pointers to new data, we have to put data there somehow. And that's our data blocks. Yes? Do we log after we write each of those? Or do we log after we write everything? Neither. We always log first before we actually do any updates to the real data. That answer your question? Okay, so let's now have a crash. So let's say I finish writing the log, which I mentioned happens first, and I update the free block map and the indirect blocks, you know, containing the block pointers. What is going to be written after we start? It's part of this. Okay. Yeah, question?
Oh, I thought you were asking.
Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with who thinks A is going to be updated? Be written to, rather, I should say. So that's what the question asks. So some people, okay. So the answer is yes. We're going to overwrite with the same thing. Okay, we're going to redo the update even though it was already done. So it's not going to have any net effect, but we are going to write to the free block map, you know, or try to, or at least detect, or like look at it and say, oh, it's, we already did this. It's already the same. But we're going to do something akin to writing to it, even though it's not going to have any effect. So with same data, how about the data blocks to the file? Are those going to be updated? Yes, okay, so most people say yes, and I say yes because we better do it because we haven't done it yet. But we're going to redo the entire operation. So how about indirect blocks? So we're going to, so plurality, yeah. So, and this is a case where we're going to overwrite with the same data. The same data. So we're just going to redo that. How about the data blocks for the directory? Thinks we're going to, nope, still not going to change those. How about the inode for the file? We're going to update that. Most people say yes, that was part something we had to do before. We're still going to have to do it, it wasn't done. And the inode for directory we're not going to do, and the log we're still going to update to reclaim the space. Sometime later. Okay, so questions? Yes?
It makes sense to me that if we crash during the operation, we boot back up, we go back and check the log, and then we redo it. But if we crash while we're writing the log, what's the first thing that the system would do when it starts?
Question, if we crash while we're writing the log, what's going to happen? So if we go back to our example here, if we didn't write the commit, we're going to do nothing. We're just going to say, that's nice, don't care about it. If we crash after the commit, we're going to make sure we have to make sure we rewrote the log that everything that is before the commit was written, if the commit is written, and we're going to redo the operation then. Does that answer your question?
I guess I'm just confused because if we're going through program execution, like one of the steps was like open this file, and then the subsequent command like depended on that, and we were writing the log and we crashed and booted back up and just skipped over that.
So the question is, because we're writing these separate transactions to the log, couldn't one operation be dependent on another? So something we're gonna have to do that I didn't talk about in detail is we have to make sure we commit any prior operation that depends on a future one first. We're gonna have to make sure we do that in order somehow in the log. That's gonna be some extra work. The simplest way to do this, what XV6 does, is XV6 only does one transaction at a time, and it finishes it before going on to the next one. And there are better solutions where we just watch for those dependencies. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah, Buck.
For ANC, we overwrite. What was the
question, what, for ANC, we overwrite? Yes, because we did these before crashing, but we have no information that they were done before crashing, so we're going to do them again just in case.
What was the reason for
B? B is part of the normal operation, so we better do it at some point, especially since it wasn't done before. Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Does the reclaim remove the commit?
Question, the reclaim remove the commit? Yes. It makes it so we can use that space in the log to store the next operation. Yes. git commit means it's not done, unlike git commit. So yes and no. So commit means it's done in the sense that if once we commit, we're not going to lose it. But yes, it doesn't mean that we've actually finalized the operation. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
What happens if you're writing the log and then when you write the log, it crashes?
What happens if we're writing the log and then we write the log, it crashes? I think I went over this before. It just depends on which of these two cases we get into. If we didn't write the commit, we're just going to ignore what was written. We did write the commit, we're going to redo that. We're going to do that operation.
When you're writing the log, we crash.
Question, if you're writing the log, we crash, yes. So if you're writing the log and we crash, some part of what we're trying to write is going to be in the log. If that part doesn't include a commit, we're just going to ignore it. If it does, we're going to do that operation on reboot. Okay, so something to note about real journaling file systems. So I gave you the impression that we just do the entire operation using this log, meaning that we have these nice transactions which either happen or don't happen. And a lot of journaling file systems don't use redo logging for everything. So many of them only use it for metadata operations, meaning that for creating a file, they'll have the log record the operations that modify directory entries and inodes and indirect locks and things like that, but they won't actually record the file data being modified in there. And some of them do it for both. And why would you only do it for metadata? Well, because it's faster. But this means that on a crash, you could have your created file that has blocks that point to junk. And they said, well, that's fine, the file system's still consistent, even though, yes, that's less optimal. But this is just sort of a common, deliberate design decision that file systems have made, is that they said, oh, writing this data twice is slow, we're going to avoid that, even though that means that we might have some data be missing after a crash, or be inconsistent with the state of the file system. But we're going to make sure that at least we don't have this scenario of, like, you move a file and it's in both directories or anything like that. So questions about this notion of different degrees of consistency. So, and I say it's a choice because you'll see there's real journaling file systems that are in common use that take both of these choices, that both do everything is journaled, and which do only stuff that isn't the actual file data is journal, only the metadata, the things like block pointers, inodes, directory entries, and so on. Yes?
How does metadata avoid duplicate writing?
Question, how does metadata avoid duplicate writing? We do duplicate writing in the metadata case, but it's so much less than if we're doing everything.
Why is it so much less?
Why is it so much less? Let's think of modifying a gigabyte file. How much metadata am I going to write to do that? Like, I'm going to write probably like kilobytes of metadata, all the block pointers. If I'm doing the second option that I'm using logging for everything, I'm going to write a gigabyte of data to the log, and then a gigabyte to the rest of the disk. If I'm only doing metadata, I'm going to write a couple kilobytes to the log, and then a couple kilobytes to the rest of the disk, plus a gigabyte to the rest of the disk. Other questions? Yeah. Quick question, with the past two exercises for FAT, the data blocks for the directory would be modified? Yes, because that's where we store things like file size information in FAT. With inode-based file systems, our directory entries don't have any of that type of information. Just a file name, that's it.
File name and pointer.
A file name and the index into the actual file information, which shouldn't need to change once we've assigned it. Okay, so our next topic is going to be about distributed systems. So new topic. And this is about multiple machines working together to form a single task. And we're going to have sort of two divergent models you might think of for these. So one is what we'll call the client-server model, where I have a server which is a single machine, which talks to many clients, versus sort of the opposite extreme is a what we'll call a peer-to-peer model, where I have a bunch of machines, none of which is more special than the other, which talk in some arbitrary way to each other. And we're going to mostly talk about the client-server model because it's basically what everyone ends up using, even though maybe there's some problems with it. And we're not going to try to talk about models in between because those also aren't very common. Usually people sort of think about one extreme or the other. But you know, we're only have a short time to cover it. So in the client-server model, we have a server and a client. The client is sometimes on. So in this model, clients send requests to server. They need to know how to contact the server. The server does not know how to contact the clients unless they send a request to them. So the server is at a well-known location. It responds to requests from clients, but it doesn't initiate contact with clients. If the client wants to get something from the server, how it has to do that is it has to ask the server for it because the server can't proactively tell it. Questions? This client-server view. Okay. And commonly, we'll have layers of servers. So sort of a lot of what the real world looks like in data centers and the like is we'll have, for example, you have your web client, your web browser, that talks to a web server. So it's a client for that. And the web server might itself be a client of another server to implement whatever application you're doing. And that application might be the client of yet more servers to implement the functionality of that application, to like find ads or database or record data. This is sort of a common to have this sort of layers of client-server interaction, a very common sort of architecture for especially things on websites and the like. Yes? Question, what's the on the peer-to-peer diagram, I used the word node instead of server or client. What's the definition of a node? It's just another name for machine in this context. There's no explicit definition.
So is there any example of a peer-to-peer distributed system?
Question, is there any example of a peer-to-peer distributed system? Yes, I guess classically probably the largest example I know of, which I assume still exists, is the BitTorrent DHT. There's probably some others I can think of. And there's things which are kind of in between. But we're not going to have time to go into the detail about all sorts of interesting ways to architect distributed systems. And arguably, DHT isn't like, it's peer-to-peer, but it doesn't look like this. Okay, so we have these layers of servers in our more common architecture. And I have this sort of hypothetical example, but we can get some real examples. So if you look up Wikipedia, it's very open about how they operate Wikipedia. And they have this architecture here where basically most of these arrows represent client-server interactions. They have lots of layers here. So your request comes in. It goes to a load balancer server, which talks to a server that handles encryption, which talks to servers with handle crash caching, which talks to a log server, which talks to application servers, which talk to database and log servers, and so on. So we have all these layers. This really is how people architect websites, that sort of way. Something that sort of maybe wasn't apparent on this diagram is that when we have like these load balancers, this is not one server, but like 50 different servers that your client could contact any one of. And that's sort of a common thing to do on services like this. And same thing with probably most of these layers. There's like lots of copies of the same server with the same functionality. Okay. So talked about sort of the client-server architecture. I mentioned peer-to-peer. It just means we don't have an always-on server anyone knows about. Any machine can contact any other, and we have to think about how the network organizes. We're not going to go into details about how you do non-client server style designs. That's probably a whole topic for potentially another whole course we could teach. But we're going to talk about distributed systems generally. And a question we might have is, why do we want a distributed system? And a reason we might want that is there's some different reasons. So one set of reasons are social. That we might have different machine owners working together. So if we have two banks that want to do transactions with each other, probably Bank A is going to want to control their servers with their data, and Bank B is going to want to control their servers, but they're going to need to work together to actually do transactions between customers of the two different banks. And that's going to be a distributed system, not because there's a reason we can't run that technically on one machine, but because we have collaboration and each of the collaborators wants things on their own machine. Another reason we might have a distributed system is that you might want to delegate something to someone else. So if you want to store your data in the cloud, like you could store your data locally, but you are saying that I want someone else to be responsible for this part of the functionality. I don't want to worry about the details of handling backup and so on for that. So I'm going to make a distributed system. We're going to have more machines involved to get that extra functionality. Or to get that delegation of responsibility, I should say, even if it's not extra functionality. So those are sort of social reasons why we have distributed systems, and they're very common. There's also some technical reasons we might want distributed systems, even if, you know, it's all the same entity in control of all the machines. So one is that we can combine cheap machines to do the functionality that previously would have to be done by a very expensive machine. So another is that we might want something where it's easier to add capacity incrementally. If we think of doing things on an expensive machine, so for example, in the mid-90s, a common way you'd run a website for your startup is you get like $1 million machine from Sun Microsystems. And you know, that's very expensive. These are machines that aren't very common, so they're extra expensive for what they do compared to smaller machines. And also, when you want to upgrade that machine, your upgrade procedure is, well, replace your $1 million machine with a $1.5 million machine. Versus with the distributed system, hopefully you can just add more machines incrementally and add capacity that way. And another reason is that we hope to have redundancy in distributed systems, that if we design things correctly, maybe we can make it so one machine in the system can fail and the whole system as a whole still works. That's something we can't really achieve with a single machine, where if it fails, obviously, it doesn't work. Question?
If the distributed system is the server to client model and there's only one server?
Question, if the distributed system is the server to client model and it's only one server?
And if that one fails,
question, if that one fails, would the system not work? So if we have one server and clients, if the server fails, we probably lost most of our functionality of the system. But we could have like several servers the clients could contact. That's an easy way of mitigating that. And even if we only have one server and it fails, we haven't lost all functionality potentially. So for example, something we can relatively easily do is the clients can have their last version of the data and at least we have some functionality. Does that answer your question? Yes. How are most load balancers actually implemented? That is probably a topic for a networking class that we're not going to go into. That's not the part of distributed systems we're going to go into. I think it's interesting. I also don't know the details offhand. I know how some load balancers work, but it's not the part we're going to go into much. Other questions? Yeah.
How is it possible that, like, if one machine fails, the system still works?
Question about a peer-to-peer network, and one of the machines is dependent by all the other machines. How is a possible system works? Probably not. But we can design peer-to-peer networks where no machine depends on any other one machine. Okay, so let's talk about machines communicating. And we have to talk about how we communicate. And I'm going to talk about sort of a simple model of how we can talk between different machines. And this is going to be what I'll call the mailbox model, that we can send and receive messages. So in this model, I have a machine A, and we have a network. And basically, I can send a message tagged with who it's for to the network. In this case, it's for machine B. And here I'm saying hello. And machine B is going to get that from the network somehow. And I'm saying a way we might imagine the programming interface for this would look is that I like say send, identify machine B somehow, and I say hello. And on machine B, I enter receive, and I get hello. So the network knows how to get the message for B. When we send the message on the network, we have some sort of what we might call an envelope saying it goes to B. And there's going to be a queue of messages waiting to be sent, and there's a queue of messages that have been sent over the network but not yet handled by the receiving program, and we might call this sort of our mailbox. So I can send messages with an address, kind of like an envelope in the mail, and they get received in this mailbox, and I can call this receive function to take things out of my mailbox. So that's sort of our simple model of how stuff goes over the network. Yes? Isn't this the same thing as a database? So no, for several reasons. So one thing is database traditionally on one machine. Another thing is when I send something and receive it, it's gone. Once I receive something, it goes out of the mailbox. Right, it's not permanent storage. When I receive something, I get that message kind of like reading from a pipe. Right, it's not in the pipe anymore once I read something from a pipe. So when is this actually used? So this is an abstract model of the functionality networks provide. The functionality, what functionality is that? The functionality to send stuff from one machine to another. So there's lots of ways we could do that. This is sort of a model of how that's exposed by the network. Question, yeah?
Is the mailbox machine a queue of messages waiting to send?
So in this example, I have a queue of messages. This is like a send queue, and there's like a receive queue here. And we're going to do this in both directions. So we're also going to have the equivalent sort of in the other direction. We'll have a set of messages waiting to be sent and a set of messages received but not handled by the program in the other direction. Other questions? Yeah.
Like this is basically just zooming in on the actual connection between two networks.
Question, this is just zooming in the connection between two machines? Yes. And sort of giving an abstraction of what functionality the network provides. Take networking if you want to know like actual details about how this sort of stuff works. So in the client-server model, servers want to reply to clients. And this mailbox model seems to not actually allow that, but we can build it with this mailbox idea. So what we're going to do is we're going to send a return address. And there's a common abstraction we're going to implement that's going to be provided by operating systems built on top of a network that provides this sort of mailbox abstraction to let us make a two-way channel for messages. So how we're going to build a two-way channel when all we can do is send sort of the equivalent of letters, right? Well, we're going to send a message to B saying, hey, I'd like to open a connection. And B is going to send back, hey, okay, I'm set to do that. And then from a programmer point of view, we're going to get some object that represents the connection. So on A, I got this from this connect function. On B, I got this from this accept function. And when I send things on the connection over the network, I'm going to implement that by labeling, oh, this is a message for B from A. And so B can realize that it's part of that particular connection and not from some unrelated thing. And we can do this in both directions. So B can send replies and say, this is a reply for A from B. Questions about sort of this connection idea. So, yes.
So in this case, connection object contains the return address?
Question, in this case, the connection object contains the return address? Yeah. Or I would say, I guess maybe not, that's not the right way to put it. We send the return address. The return address is kind of like known to the machine, but the connection object knows what address we expect messages from. And whenever we send a message, we're always going to send it with the return address, so they know who the message came from. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So for the client-server model, like you mentioned that you have to like send some return address. Is that so they can like distinguish between the different connections?
Question. Do I have to send a return address so we can distinguish between the different connections? That's one reason why. But another reason why is that in the client-server model, our client, machine A here, knows about B, but B never knew about A in advance. So we have to tell B that, hey, there's a machine called A we want to talk to, because it wouldn't know otherwise. Does that answer your question? So the return address is, when you send the return address, it's your own address, right? It's the address you want messages back on. And the server doesn't know the address of any of the clients in advance. So we have to tell it each time we contact it. Because the clients, you remember, are sometimes on. They aren't always up. The server doesn't know all of them. They vary. So we have to tell it who the clients are. And this is how we're going to do that. When we open the connection, we're going to say, hey server, you want to talk to A right now. Please talk to A. This is A asking to talk to you.
Does the server have any memory of like which machines it's contacted?
Does the server have any memory of which machines it's contacted in the past? So the server will have memory of which machines it has active connections to. Okay, other questions? Okay, so POSIX implements connections, and it implements them with a very similar API that looks like two-directional pipes. And they work like pipes, except they work in both directions. And the POSIX API, this is called sockets. So I'm not going to go over the detailed API to use sockets on the network. We're going to have some other thing we're going to do for an assignment coming up. But basically, POSIX gives you a file descriptor, like a pipe file descriptor, that represents the connection, and you can read or write on that. When you read from it, it reads messages that were sent by the other end of the connection. When you write to it, it sends a message to the other end of the connection. And on the other end of the connection, they have their own file descriptor that works in the same way. Some questions about sort of this idea that these connections basically are two-directional pipes. Once we set them up. Questions? Okay. And so the internet, you know, provides this mailbox style communication. That's sort of the underlying, what the underlying network provides. And on top of it, we implement these connections that actually handle things. So, and if you want to know the full details of how do we deal with like failures and things like that, take networking. Not going to have time to go into all those details. But there's some things we do want to talk about, which are sort of more sort of system design issues. So one is, like, how do we actually specify machines? So in my examples, I've said we have a machine A and machine B, right? But that's not how things work in the real world. We have to have some way of identifying a particular machine. How can we do that? And also, we have to deal with what if there are multiple programs on a machine. So I've sort of given the idea that like we send something to machine A, and machine A handles it, but we know we're running an OS on like machine A, which could have multiple things running. How do we know which program to go to? So, for example, if I SSH into a machine, how do I know it's SSH and not my contacting the web server that's also running on that machine, right? We have to have a way of doing that. So first, let's talk about this first problem of how do we specify what machine to talk to? And there's sort of two ways we'll do that. So one is we have names for machines, and on the internet, our names are what I'll call host names, like www.virginia.edu. This is not the format the network actually expects. The network, if we're sending those messages to those mailboxes, it wants to have addresses. And there are sort of two formats for addresses, one from IP version 4, another from IP version 6. And they're often represented like this, but they're really just numbers. And this sort of idea of having names for something and addresses is actually common elsewhere too. Like if we think of file names, you have your file name, that's nice and easy to read, but we learned on an inode-based file system, what the file system actually cares about is we have an inode number and what device it's a part of. The same sort of idea, that you use this name to access it, but the actual sort of finding blocks in the file are done with the inode number. They're not done with that name. Or you have a variable named counter, but you actually access that when the machine is running with a memory address. And similar. Okay, questions?
That variable counter is the floating counter?
Question, that variable counter, this is like if I have code that's like int counter, right? There's a variable named counter. That variable is going to have some address, like say 7FFF9430, and that's what the machine's going to actually deal with. And the same idea, you're going to have a name like, you know, www.virginia.edu. That's what you're going to deal with, but what the network's actually going to deal with is some IP address like 128.148.2236. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So you mentioned how like connections have the extra operations of connect and accept, but like, why exactly does that matter?
Question, why does it matter that connections have extra operations like connect and accept? That's so we can have sort of an object to represent a single set of communication between two machines. How does that differ from just sending stuff? So it's going to give us this notion that it looks like a two-way pipe.
Isn't it a two-way pipe?
And we're going to have, so the question is, why isn't this the same as just receiving stuff? And it's a two-way pipe between two particular machines. Right? If we think of a server talks to lots of machines, lots of clients. And we're going to have a separate connection for each client we talk to. And that's sort of the important thing. And also the connection is going to tie together the first thing the client sends to the second thing the client sends for us. Does that answer your question? Okay, so we have these names and addresses. And if you take a networking course, you'll learn that there's a distributed system that handles mapping these names to these names, these addresses that the network uses, but the network is dealing with these addresses, which are just numbers. So we have these addresses. So in IPv4 addresses, you've seen, I wrote these as sort of four numbers separated by dots. They're typically 32-bit numbers. Or they're really 32-bit numbers, they're just written this way to represent them not as one big number. And they're assigned to organizations in blocks. So for example, UVA has all the IP addresses that start 128.143, and Google has like all these ranges written on the slide and so on. So they're just assigned in big blocks. That being assigned in blocks is going to be important later. IPv6 addresses basically work the same as IPv4, except rather than being a 32-bit number, they're a 64-bit number, and they decided to write it out in hex, omitting some of the zeros, with colons to make it clear where things are. And I would note that there's some special IPv4 and IPv6 addresses. So the most notable one is 127.0.0.1 is reserved for the current machine. It just always means the current machine, no matter where we are, not on the internet. And for IPv6, the address ::1, which is all zeros and a one, is reserved for the current machine in IPv6. There's also some IPv6 addresses reserved for things that aren't on the internet, and similar for IPv4, where, probably most notably, addresses with 192.168 are things that aren't on the internet. They're just on a local network. Okay. So if we have these IP addresses, how do we actually send messages? How does the network actually implement our mailbox model? And basically what we're going to have is we're going to have routers. And because we allocate these addresses in these big blocks, the routers can just have a table which says, oh, if I receive data for UVA, it's going to be this range, it goes to network one. If I receive data for this range, it goes to that network one. If I receive data for this range, it goes to network two, and so on. So they can just have a table for all the ranges of addresses, where do they want to send the messages? And if you're like, if you're close to the quote-unquote center of the internet, these tables can get pretty big, but the numbers I've heard are like on the order of 150 to 300,000 entries, which is manageable. Okay, so another thing we need to deal with is if I have multiple programs on one machine, who gets a message? And so far I've said we specify a machine, but that really doesn't work because if I think of a typical machine that's doing something interesting on the network, it's running multiple services. So for example, on Kaitos, where our submission site is hosted, we have a web server. I have SSH access to that machine to do things. We have the server for the office hour queue. Those are three different programs, and when I make a connection to that server, I have to know which program to contact. So how do we make that happen? So the IP address, that address, isn't enough because that identifies a machine. It doesn't identify a program. And so what we do is we add port numbers. And you can kind of think of this like having one address with PO boxes at it. So this specifies at this machine what box do I go to, where there's going to be one for each program. And on the internet, they just chose to add 16-bit port numbers, so we have 2 to the 16 possible boxes. And we just assign these numbers to particular programs. And typically, what's done is the lower parts of these numbers are assigned for particular services. So like 80 or 443 are assigned to web servers, 22 is assigned to an SSH server, and so on. Just statically, we agree that if we're SSHing to a machine, we're going to try port 22. We also have a range which are allocated on demand. And this is because if I'm a client contacting a server, I want to generate a return address, and that return address needs to specify what program is trying to talk to that server. Because I could like run two different web browsers on my machine, I need to know which web browser do we talk back to. We give each of them a different port number, and that's how we distinguish. Question?
Do I
have two sessions of SSH? Do they both use the same port? They both send to the same port and receive on different ones. Does that answer your question?
Wait, so you have A machine SSH to second B machine.
So question, if I have machine A SSH to machine B, machine A will be sending to port 22 on machine B. It will be sending with the return addresses from two different ports on machine A. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, why do I need blocks of IPs for organizations? So the idea of this IP address is that it would hopefully represent one machine, and organizations typically have a whole bunch of machines. Now, you may know from your home internet setup that we can do things where we have multiple machines using one IP address, but to implement that, we have to do some fancy translation to make it so if, you know, machine A and B are both trying to access something else, that we make it so they use different port numbers, typically by translating the port numbers they use, unbeknownst to them. And this is called network address translation, something I'll just mention exists. So there's a way where we, you know, have multiple machines share an IP address by having the machines, you know, think they're using one port number, but we fix the port numbers they're using so they can share an IP address on the external network. But that's more of a networking topic and not what IP was designed for, but it's unfortunately a lot of how we use it today, especially because we haven't really transitioned to IPv6 where we would have enough addresses to not worry about that problem. Other questions? Yes?
Does every website have a unique IP address? If so, is it
question, does every website have a unique IP address? And the answer is no. Part of what the information sent to a web server is the name used to contact it. And for that reason, you'll see two websites on the same IP address that show different things. But it's the one web server that's implementing both of them. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so earlier I mentioned sockets. And so sockets are, as I mentioned, are POSIX abstraction of a connection. So they represent a connection and they act like a bi-directional pipe. So we can write to one end of a socket on the client, we'll have a file descriptor and the server can read. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll have, you know, different operations to create a socket. So the way things work with the POSIX socket API, I'm just gonna mention briefly, is on the server, we'll create what we call a server socket. And that represents a server that's waiting for connections. And the client will create a socket to connect to the server, and the server will call this listen operation saying, I'm waiting for connections. The client is going to use this connect operation, and that's going to have let the server accept that connection, and that will make a unique file descriptor for each client they're talking to. And that's what represents the connection we talked about earlier. And to do this operation, we're going to have our address here. This is going to be a server IP plus port. And this connection will be associated with a particular pair of client and server IPs and port numbers. So questions? Yeah.
How does the client already know like what ports you want that you want to use?
Cut question, how does the client know what ports it wants to use? You mean to connect what port to connect to? That is going to have to be specified statically. So for example, for web servers, we just say, we're going to use one of these two port numbers. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah?
Why does the client send the file descriptor?
What?
Why does the client send the file descriptor?
Why is the file send the client descriptor? Sorry, the client doesn't send the file descriptor. The file descriptor is used by the OS to identify what connection to associate this operation with. But the file descriptors don't go over the network. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. And so with this model, we have a file descriptor for each active connection and also an extra file descriptor to represent accepting new connections. And on my machine, I can use a command to dump a table of here are the open file open sockets I have. And you can see that each of them have a local address they're associated with. So we have an IP address and a port number and a remote address they're associated with. And each of these corresponds to one of those file descriptors in a client or server program. So for example, this first one here, it goes to the port that's used for SSH, so this is probably my SSH client's connection, which is associated with a file descriptor it has, it uses to talk to the SSH server. some questions. This, okay. So that's about sockets. So we're not gonna mostly use sockets on future assignments. That's probably more of a thing if we take networking, but I want you to know that they're sort of the OS level abstraction for talking on the network, right? We have a way of creating this file descriptor that, you know, where we, which represents one connection from a client to a server, and the server can get multiple of these, one for each client it's talking to, by making that server socket and calling accept over and over again to get new clients. Okay, so there's another model for communicating between machines that we can implement on top of this socket model called remote procedure calls. And the goal here is that, well, the socket model is kind of two-way pipes, and that's just useful, but it's not actually a very natural way to run programs. Right, it's not like sort of what we think of doing when we want to do something on a machine. So another model is that I write some functions and I have some way of calling those functions from a different machine. And ideally, some tool or library would handle all the details of doing this. That it would just be I call a function and it runs on a remote machine. And this idea is called remote procedure calls. And we can implement remote procedure calls by writing a tool or library that uses sockets. So it's going to open a connection using that sort of model I showed you earlier, and we're going to send stuff on that connection to make it so I, on the client side, just called a function, but it opened a connection, and I, on the server side, just implemented that function, but it was called because the client opened that connection. And sort of a hope of this design is that this means that unlike our sockets, that it should be transparent, meaning that there should be no difference between making a local function call and calling these remote procedure calls, unlike using these sockets, which is very unnatural compared to like using a library, and a little bit unnatural compared to even talking to a local program via a pipe. So there's all these extra steps. As we'll see, this is a common goal of remote procedure call systems, but real remote procedure call systems maybe only get halfway there. There's a lot of things about them which are going to be different than local calls and maybe more awkward than local calls. So how are we going to implement this design here where rather than you having to like write all these functions to deal with sockets and these special types of file descriptors, that you just like write normal calls? Well, the RPC implementation is gonna use what we'll call stubs. So stubs are gonna be a wrapper that stands in for the remote machine. So on the client side of this system, you're gonna call a stub to run something on a remote machine. And that stub is gonna look like the function you're calling, but instead of being implemented by doing that operation locally, it's gonna be implemented by telling the remote machine to do it. On the server side, we're gonna have a corresponding stub, which is gonna take input not from being called directly, but from a network connection, and gonna trigger that operation on your implementation on the remote machine. So sort of what we'll end up with is that you're gonna call this stub function. It's going to communicate via sockets with a server machine, which is gonna have a stub function that calls your actual implementation on the server. And from your point of view, it's just gonna appear you make a function call, you get a return value, and it comes from a different server machine. Yes?
So this is what we're implementing two-phase?
Question is, this what we're implementing two-phase? No, but you are gonna use an RPC system in two-phase. So in two-phase, rather than using sockets, you're going to make function calls that are gonna call something on a server. Does that answer your question? So you're gonna be a user, so all this stuff here, all this stuff on the right-hand side here, this is a library, you're gonna be using such a library.
So we don't actually have to implement that?
Yes. Question back there?
Like, where is this function call implemented? Is it like a system call or something?
question, where is this function call implemented? So you, using this library, are going to specify, I want to be able to call my, you know, display picture function, or get picture function, right? So you're going to specify, tell it about get picture. It's going to make a stub for get picture because you told it that. And that's how the function is going to be chosen. Does that answer your question? Good. Other questions? Okay, so we'll finish up talking about how this works and what the interface might look like next time.